Welcome back to Dark Florida, the podcast where we wander off trail and into the unknown. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, and today we're trading palm trees for pine-covered peaks as we head deep into the mysterious White Mountains of New Hampshire, a place where something ancient might still be watching from the shadows. Before we get into this thrilling conversation, mark your calendar, folks, because Saturday, September 20th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., come join us for a free community event at 777 South Highway 314A in Okalawaha, Florida. It's being hosted by Bigfoot World and the Cryptids and Paranormal Researchers of Central Florida. And it's going to be a day packed with exclusive evidence clips, theories from the field, paranormal discussion, and a live Q&A. And most importantly, a space for you to share your strange encounters. We'll have light refreshments and a whole lot of weird and even more connection. Whether you're deep into the research or just Bigfoot curious, you do not want to miss it. And don't forget, if you enjoy the show and want to support the journey into the unexplained, you can leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening and share the show with a friend. It really does help. And be sure to follow along on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast. If you have a story to share or would like to be a guest on the show, you can email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. You can also support the show by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. Now, let's get into today's episode. Our guest is Jeb Scruggs, a rugged outdoorsman, founder of Squatch Hunters International, and someone who went from Bigfoot agnostic to full-on flesh and blood believer after something life-changing happened in the White Mountains. These mountains are known not only for their beauty, but for the strange, remote, rugged, and for those who know where to look, haunted by more than just wind in the trees. Tonight, Jeb's pulling back the curtain on what really lives in those woods, what his encounter revealed, and why the truth might be more real and more terrifying than you think. Let's dive in. I'm so happy that you were able to come on. I've seen your work on Instagram and I was really intrigued. I have some friends and fellow podcasters up in New Hampshire, Ron from New England. I'm not sure if you've heard of him or not. And he's had some Sasquatch activity in his town. So when I saw you were up there in the White Mountains doing research, I knew that I needed to hear more about this. Welcome to Dark Florida. And can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. My name's Jeb Scruggs. I'm one of the members of Squatch Hunters International. We are a small organization of like-minded individuals who all believe in the pursuit of our hairy friend out in the woods. We all have our own little niche specialties. I'm just more of an outdoorsy guy who likes to spend as much time as he can up in the mountains. And after seeing something about a little over a year ago, I definitely got a little more interested in my pursuit. And was a little more targeted after that.
What happened to you a year ago? Did you have an encounter?
So this was probably about, I think about May. It was definitely May of last year. It was just happened to be my birthday. And me and Mrs. Scruggs were spending a weekend up in a little town called Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is just about the most adorable little town you could imagine up there. Just a very small mountain charm. And I wanted to spend a nice weekend there. So we went up. And this weekend was just a run-of-the-mill kind of hiking expedition, at least from my perspective. And bless Mrs. Scruggs, she was okay with humoring me and a little squatching while we were up there, just a little adventuring around in the mountains. And this happened to be a Saturday, and we were just hiking up, it was called Bald Peak. This was over by Mount Kinsman. So this was just up in the White Mountains, just to the west of the Notch. And this was kind of just, we thought it was going to be your normal weekend excursion, so we got to the trail, and we just happened to be the only people on this whole trail, because in May, it's still fairly early. It's not quite warm and summery yet. You're still waiting for the little leaves to pop out of the trees, and we were just completely remote on this trail. So we got to the top, we got to the summit, and we sat down. We ate our little peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, as you know, they never taste better than they do on top of a mountain, right?
Absolutely.
So we sat down, we ate, and we're very much enjoying the fact that we were the only folks up in this mountain. It's very rare to find a trail in the White Mountains where you can be completely secluded. It's a very popular destination for, you know, hikers and all sorts of winter activities as well, skiers and such. It's a very big tourist destination. So we were on the way back down, and I've got probably about 10 inches on Mrs. Scruggs, so my stride tends to be a little bit longer. I walk a little bit faster, particularly when going downhill. I tend to pick up momentum. So I was probably about, I want to say, 25, 30 yards ahead of Mrs. Scruggs, and I was just kind of taking the trail on like you would, and I get to a turn. And I hear like a rustling in the bushes, and I think nothing of it. It could very well be, you know, as something as small as a chipmunk. Most of the time it's a bird. I don't know how often you're out in the trail and you hear a little skittering, but you know, your imagination begins to run, but oftentimes it's just something pretty innocuous.
Right.
But this particular time I saw, or I heard the rustling, and then I saw like a little hairy face from around the corner, and immediately I think bear. This has got to be a bear. We're coming into, you know, the spring season. They're just coming out of hibernation. They are hungry, and you know, they might be a little aggressive because of that. So I did what every seasoned outdoorsman does when they see a creature that could potentially harm them. And I ran like a little girl up the trail, and I just kind of beat feet. I ran back up to Mrs. Scruggs, and she says, I look like I saw a ghost because my face was just like straight white. This was actually the first time I've ever seen a bear in the wild. Like I've, you know, never actually seen one in person. And I'm thinking like, oh man, I know they say, you know, what is it? If it's brown, lay down. If it's black, fight back, look big, jump up and down, make noise. I mean, I'm trying to remember which advice to follow, because I feel like if I follow the wrong advice, I'm going to get mauled out here. So I get back up to Mrs. Scruggs and I just say, hey, I think I saw a bear. Let's wait and see if it'll pass. So we're sitting there and we are just dead quiet. You can hear the breeze going through the trees and I barely dare to breathe. And you start to hear crunches of twigs from that same direction. And it appears to be getting closer. So these delicate little footsteps could have, again, it sounded like it could have been a squirrel going by. It sounded like it could have been a bird, but I just hear it rhythmically, just step, step, step. And I look to the, I guess what is to the left of me at this point, and I see a clearing, probably, you know, I want to say another 30 yards out, but you can kind of see this little clearing. And I see that creature emerge from the tree line, take a step, and it looked over, and the second it looked over and saw me, Mrs. Scruggs, this thing stood up on two legs, and it boogied. It ran on two legs. This thing stood straight up and just booked it. And while it was running, I could see arm sways going left, going right, and then it disappeared into the tree line. And of course, I look over and I'm like, oh my God, did you see that? And she says, no. And I'm like, how did you miss that? That was, I don't know what that was. Because I've seen bears, you know, toddle on two legs before. There's actually a cutesy little tourist trap up here called Clark's Trading Post, where they have trained black bears who, you know, in exchange for a little bit of ice cream, they'll dance in a tutu, or they'll ride on a bike or a scooter or a barrel or what have you. But when a bear goes on two legs, they do not walk like a creature on two legs. They walk like a toddler, just you know, toddling back and forth, and they do not know or look like they know what they're doing. But this creature I saw that day was walking with purpose. It was walking like a man would walk, and it disappeared into that tree line, and I didn't see it again. Now,
that's terrifying.
Yeah, it was a very scary moment. I mean, one, because at first I thought it was a bear, and I was already in bear defense mode, and she was also in bear defense mode. And the second, you know, I lost line of sight, she's like, let's go, we got to get out of here. And I wanted to, you know, stop and check the check the tree line, see if there's any breaks in the limbs or any prints. God, I really wanted to see if I can find a print or two. Right. But she was just so insistent we get off that mountain at that time because she was insistent it was a bear.
Yeah, the adrenaline's dumping.
Absolutely.
You said at first you thought it was a bear, but when you got a good, clear look at it, could you describe some of the characteristics and color?
Yeah, certainly. So it was like a dark brownish, like, I won't say red, but like a very dark, dark brown fur. And up here in New England, we don't really have brown bears or grizzly bears. We only have black bears. And the behavior I thought was black bearish at first because, like I said earlier with the little folksy rhyme or whatever, black bears are probably the most cowardly creature you'll ever see in the woods. All you have to do is yell at them mean-like and they tend to scamper off. So that was my first gut reaction based on its behavior, but the two-legged bipedal motion is just not something that a bear does. And it actually took over a year for me to come to terms with the fact that, you know, that wasn't a bear. And it's because maybe back in February of this year, I saw that Ronnie LeBlanc was down at the local library. He was giving a presentation. It was called simply, like, What is Bigfoot? Are you familiar with Ronnie LeBlanc?
I am.
Yeah, so he is based down in Massachusetts. He's Leominster State Forest is kind of his stomping grounds, and he's got all sorts of paranormal sightings in Leominster. And you know, when it comes to Sasquatch, there's kind of two kind of camps. You have the you have the flesh and blood folks, and then you have the paranormal interdimensional, you know, energy, ley line, magical spheres of energy type of folks as well. And I find myself more in the flesh and blood camp now, but I definitely wanted to hear what Mr. LeBlanc had to say. Just my curiosity, what camp do you fall in when it comes to the flesh and blood versus not so flesh and blood?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Well, this is about you, but I'm definitely, I'm into the woo, but I always say I'm very open-minded to wherever the data takes me. Personally, there's some theories I really get into the missing 411 stuff. Mm-hmm. That really interests me. And the lines of how it seems like Bigfoot and the supernatural seem to cross. And you have this very physical being with almost supernatural capabilities sometimes. So, but I'm totally open-minded. I'm agnostic, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to characterize where I am too, because I'm definitely in the like flesh and blood. I believe there is this physical natural creature, but I'm open to the supernatural as well. But I'm still kind of keeping my mind open.
My research partner is very flesh and blood, so we love to get into those types of comments. That's why I say I'm open minded because she makes some very excellent points.
So this was probably about February this year. I saw Mr. LeBlanc and he kind of had this presentation he was given, and I was very interested in what he was saying about his findings down in Massachusetts. And the more he was talking about it, he talked about different Class A sightings down there, different Class B sightings, and he mentions just all manner of supernatural activity down there. And it made me think in that moment, I'm like, well, hell, was that what I saw last year?
Right.
Like, it certainly sounds like it, because this thing was not acting like a bear, and what else could have been if not a bear?
Yeah. Were you into Bigfoot before this sighting, or did this kind of launch you into the world of Sasquatch and the weird and the paranormal? Or were you into this before? Did you have any kind of general knowledge on it before you had your sighting?
So it was very, very general, very kind of, you know, like, oh, what if in the background of the mind before this event? Like, I didn't really think much into it. Like, whenever I was hiking, or whenever I was fishing, or just whenever I was out in the woods, I wasn't thinking, you know, what signs should I be looking for that could be potential signs of a Bigfoot out here. But it was always kind of a thought since back in college. I mean, I had some friends that actually most of them are still members of Squatch Hunters International. And, you know, it was kind of a fun thing to think about. But ever since that experience last year, I've gotten much more serious in my pursuits. So now that the weather is warmed up, we actually have some nice warm green weather here. I'm out on the trail 2-3 times a week trying to track down what I can up here.
So that's kind of how you got started researching in the White Mountains. And now, is that where you research specifically?
So we are, well, I say we. We're all based all over the country. So we have one of our correspondents down in Florida. We have a correspondent in Colorado, one in Washington, Oregon, and one in Texas as well. But me, I'm primarily here in New England, mostly New Hampshire. I'm based in essentially central New Hampshire. So the White Mountains is a very popular spot for me because there's just very few places in this world that has prettier country than the White Mountains. So I'll be up there all the time, and I'm trying to kind of branch out too. So sometimes Vermont, sometimes up to Maine, and trying to do more down in Massachusetts, especially knowing we got Monsterland down there at Leominster State Forest. It's remarkable how frequently you'll be just hiking through the woods and you will just literally stumble across like a cemetery. Like you'll see some real old relics of the colonial times up here. You'll see the old stone walls.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is so interesting. Ron talks about that sometimes, is the stone walls just in the middle of nowhere, what they really stood for. That is so interesting.
Yeah, and it's remarkable too, because you have a lot of the tree growth here in New England. A lot of it's not that old. So the smaller trees you see up here are less than 100 years old. So you could be walking through a forest that's less than a century old, and you got these stone walls that could have very well been a clear pasture 150, 200 years ago when it was first colonized. But, you know, was it a pasture? Was it used for something else? Like, there's just so much uncertainty when it comes to what the purpose of some of these stone walls was.
Yeah. So what do you think it is about the terrain and the ecosystem of the White Mountains that makes it such a good hiding place for a creature like Bigfoot?
So specifically in New England, there's just a lot of territory that's not been incorporated into cities. So you got a lot of nice rural communities. And up in the mountains, you have just so many different resources. I actually write a couple of articles on our website at SquatchHuntersInternational.com, and I had a couple of running theories on some of the local terrain. Are you familiar with peepers at all?
Peepers, like around the tree?
Peepers, they're like the most adorable little frogs, and they are some of the loudest creatures you will ever encounter while in the woods. They've got this just shrill croak that they make, and they especially do it during the springtime when things are just starting to thaw out. You get the vernal pools. And it was running under a theory for a while that this might have some kind of connection because it's an early season food source. Like, you've got these pools that are thawing out. You've got these amphibians that are out. And I'm always trying to think, like, you know, again, flesh and blood. Let's think about what a creature needs right now. You need water. You need food. So I try to scope out these types of locations, and that's kind of what I've been targeting at least since spring of this year. So just New Hampshire specifically has got so much forest, so much woods, and the mountains too. The White Mountains are just so vast that I think that's a fantastic place for a creature such as that to spend his winters and summers.
Absolutely. You think that the seasonal changes in New Hampshire impact Bigfoot behavior or movement? Do you find more activity at certain times of years than you do others?
So funny you asked that. That was actually one of the first things that I asked Ronnie LeBlanc when he was down there, because I was a little discouraged. I'm like, well, look, I want to try to get into this, but it's winter for, you know, 7-8 months out of the year where everything's covered in snow up here. But, you know, he told me some of the encounters that he had reported to him of, you know, prints found in snow. So that leads me to also suspect that the seasons aren't going to necessarily completely dissuade Bigfoot activity. But it does seem that it maybe goes down a little bit when it gets a little colder out. So the other running theory, that this is something I'm kind of personally working with. You've seen the kind of wood structures out in the woods, right, that people seem to find?
Yes.
So I go back and forth on the purpose of these wood structures. I personally think that these are some type of temporary shelter, and that is something that, especially in the cold winters in New Hampshire, it's very far from Florida in that regard. It gets down to, you know, negatives for days at a time, and especially up in the mountains.
Yeah.
Mount Washington in particular actually is known for having the absolute worst weather in the world. And that sounds like a kind of a cutesy hyperbole, but if you look at the actual coldest days in the world, they were recorded on Mount Washington.
I saw some footage last winter from, I guess, the station that they have up there. There was a webcam that was live. And I feel like, didn't you guys break a record for the coldest day or night on record with record-breaking winds? It looked brutal.
Yeah, with the wind chill, I think it was something around negative 100 degrees in the Fahrenheit for those Imperial versus metric users. But yeah, negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit is how cold it gets up there without the with the wind chill incorporated. And you want to talk about wind? Yeah, that's I couldn't be one of the people inside that weather station up there in the winter. I would just get too stir crazy.
It would be like the movie Lighthouse.
So many movies it could be like. It could be like The Lighthouse. It could be like The Thing. It could be
yeah, a combination of them all. Yeah. So what was your theory with the structures?
Oh, apologies. I got distracted.
So No, you're fine. You're fine. So you said kind of like a temporary structure, possibly.
That's what I'm thinking, that it's some kind of shelter, because whenever I find them out in the woods, they are, you know, they're never complete. They always look to be a little old and worn down. But I'm thinking that, you know, in the deep of winter, when there's not that many folks who are able to actually make it to these remote locations, I'm thinking that this is it's some kind of shelter for you know, Bigfoot or Sasquatch to use in order to maintain a little bit of warmth during those particularly cold seasons.
Sure. Now, in your region, I understand that sometimes they can vary place to place. Sometimes you have more X's or bows, or people are finding asterisks, or just flat out nests, what they look like, the kind of like the bundled of sticks. What kind of structures are you coming across in your area that you see a lot of?
So I am seeing a healthy combination of all of those. So I will see the perfect crosses, especially near vernal pools, I've noticed. I took a bit of an interest in that this season because I learned how to find salamanders, and I've been just trying to find as many of those as possible. But I do see those X patterns near vernal pools. And then when I don't find those, I do sometimes see the asterisks. Those are often just kind of off trail. But then I also see like the teepee structures. So I'll see a bunch of sticks kind of piled together into a nice neat cone. And sometimes they're big enough that you could actually, you know, you could fit probably a Bigfoot. You fit me in there. And I'm a pretty large guy. So I can imagine Sasquatch could hunker down there as well.
Sure. And now I'm assuming that vernal pools, is that where the salamanders live?
Yeah. So vernal pools are basically in the spring. You have the snow melt and you also have a ton of rain in the spring. Because, you know what they say, April showers bring May flowers, right? And you know what May flowers bring, right?
Salamanders.
Pilgrims.
All right.
That's usually a groaner.
Good New England joke.
So in the spring, when you have that melt and that rain, you get those pools. And those are like the first signs of spring, because you finally got that white gone. You've got some life returning to the ground. And that's kind of what I think is one of the first destinations after a long, cold winter is, it's a fresh water source and also a potential food source.
That makes a lot of sense, because that's something that we think about, too, is they would need something to sustain, because they're such a large creature and they're so much bigger than we are. We've looked into the amount of water that black bears are drinking in a day down here in Florida, and I think it's somewhere in the range of like 2 gallons. So that's kind of a lot. And especially when you're out in these dry forests, at least here, we're always looking, where's the water? Because sometimes in the summertime, the water dries up. I love that theory. That's really cool. You had your sighting and you dove headfirst into the world of Bigfoot. What kind of gear or tech are you bringing out with you into the field? And are you going out there alone, or is the missus joining you? Or are you kind of just a solo researcher?
It all really does depend on the circumstance. When it's a nice, beautiful day and both of us manage to have time off work, we'll go up there together. And to her, it's a beautiful hike in the woods. And to me, it's a beautiful hike in the woods. And I'm also in the pursuit of Bigfoot. So in that regard, I catch myself to be pretty low tech. So when I'm out there, my cell phone is definitely my most valuable tool. It's got my camera. It's got a little GPS just in case I gotta get to where I need to be. But usually I'm out there, my backpack has got a big old jug of water. It's got a couple of snacks. I'll have a headlamp because oftentimes, if I'm out there past dark, I want to make sure I'm not just using my cell phone. But a lot of the time, that's it. It's just the little basics and, sometimes a cold beer. But other than that, I'm not into the gizmos or gadgets. We do have a fella down in Boston who very much into the tech. He's got the, you know, fanciest camera you can get. He's got all these little gadgets for it, lenses and such, but I'm pretty old school, pretty low tech.
Have you had any significant findings outside of your sighting? What are some of the things that you're seeing or experiencing?
So a lot of the times what we're seeing out here, I find just a ton of these wooden structures. Every time I see one, I document it and put it on the Instagram page. Everything I found is pretty much up there. In addition to that, I found a couple of prints, but they were so old and kind of worn down, I was unable to really decipher like toes or anything. So I kind of took that one with a grain of salt. But oftentimes we have these structures and we have a lot of trees that have been either twisted into unnatural forms or just completely uprooted. So to that, I actually do have a second story from about 2 or 3 weeks ago, if you'd like to hear.
Please.
Sure. So this was a couple Saturdays ago. I was hiking Mount Morgan, which is, it's in the Lakes region of New Hampshire. It's just about as center as you can be. The peak has a beautiful view of the Squam Lakes. We did document that. I showed a couple pictures of that. And it's also got it's funny, at the very end, to get to the summit, you have to climb up a ladder. And if you're acrophobic like I am, it's one of the most terrifying experiences you'll have on a trail. So you climb straight up this ladder, get to the top, and you get a nice view of the lakes. So on the way up, a trail was pretty unremarkable. I saw a couple of weird, maybe structures out in the wood line, but the trail itself was pretty solid. And then I'll have to remind you, it was a very drizzly day. This was probably the 10th Saturday in a row that it rained, which for those of us who work 9 to 5, that makes things quite difficult. It was a drizzly day, but it was windless. Like, there wasn't even the slightest of breeze that day. So it was a little humid, it was drizzly, and still. So I'm on my way back down, and while I'm hiking, I hear just a loud crash. And it's got that distinctive tree crash sound, like the creaks and eerie groaning of a big old tree tippling over. And at this point, I start running, because I hear that sound, and I think, oh, this has got to be something. So I run down, and I'm at the center of the trail, and a giant tree had actually collapsed or had been knocked over onto the trail. So I had a completely clear path going up, but now the trail was completely blocked by this big tree. And the break was, it was just such a clean break halfway up the trunk. And I couldn't explain what did that, because like I said, it was a windless day, and other than some other large creature, I don't know what could have knocked this tree over. So that's just one of those, I guess you'd say, Class B encounter is the aftermath of it, but it just had me sitting there puzzling. And as people were hiking down the trail, I'm like, hey, you guys remember this tree used to be standing here like a couple hours ago, right? And they confirmed, like, oh yeah, they thought I was a park ranger or something doing trail maintenance. Like, no, I'm looking for answers out here. What caused this? So that was just kind of a short experience that I couldn't explain that makes me believe it could be Bigfoot or something like that.
Are you experiencing any wood knocks while you're out there, or have you heard any vocalizations?
So very often when I'm out there, I will do a couple of wood knocks, and it's the most frustrating thing, because I just use my phone to record, and unless I'm recording the whole time, like, swear I got a wood knock response once. I had myself a big branch. I was knocking on this oak tree, and I was doing 2-4 rhythms. That's something a guy down in San Diego actually told me was a good responsive one. So I did the 2-4 knock, 2-4 knock, and I thought I heard something off in the distance, but I didn't have the presence of mind to record it. And I'll often do squatch calls out there too, but I can only do that when I'm alone, because Mrs. Scruggs gets really upset when I do squatch calls on a crowded hiking trail. And
makes sense.
Yeah, she doesn't want the next group of folks to come over and think that something's wrong because I'm out there hollering like a madman.
Right. She's like, at least not while I'm around.
Exactly. But I've done a couple of squatch calls where I've recorded them, and I've tried a couple of different vocalizations. Those I have not received a response on, though. Just that one knock that I thought I had. So if I was to do a survey of 100 people in my town right now, I'd wager to say about 25 of them would say that they either believe or want to believe in Bigfoot, which I'm not sure if that how that compares nationwide, but I feel like it's a little more accepted than some other states in the country. And I think that's partly because of just how rural it is up here. You just have so much woods, so many people doing outdoors activities that they get to have that appreciation for someone who might want to spend a lot more time out in the woods.
Right. You were saying that you kind of fell more into the flesh and blood camp. With that, are there any sort of legends in your area, like Native American stories that go back?
So in terms of the local kind of Native American legend, there is a location down in Massachusetts called the Bridgewater Triangle, and it is just known for supernatural activity. There were some, you know, there's been some like some ghost appearances. There have been, there's actually a swamp down there called the Hockabock Swamp, and it is called the place where spirits dwell in the Algonquin language. And some say that that is actually a very big source of, you know, power, supernatural activity. And there's the Pukwudgie is a local legend down there. But the Pukwudgie isn't quite like a Bigfoot the way we think about a Bigfoot. A Pukwudgie is kind of a folklore being. They're supposed to be
a small forest creature, right?
Yeah. It's supposed to look like a porcupine from like behind, but it's like a half human, short, squat, kind of a spirit. But in terms of Native American folklore, that's something that kind of fits in that. And I'm going well outside of the realm of Bigfoot here, but there's also Champ the Lake Monster up in Lake Champlain. Oh. So Lake Champlain is the giant lake between Vermont and New York State. And inside this lake is said to be a large kind of a Loch Ness monster type creature. Now, those stories go back to the Native American days when they believed that this creature inhabited the lake, and that during battles, there were some naval battles on the lake. They would actually try to tip over other people's canoes because the goal was to have Champ eat them.
Oh, I see.
So again, that's kind of outside of the film of Bigfoot, but that's just another Native American legend. That's something about New England is there's a lot of old relics of the Native folks that lived here before us.
No, it certainly is. It really makes me wonder, like you said, if that's sort of like a harbinger for some of the strange and unusual activity that happens up there. And yeah, I've heard of the Bridgewater Triangle. So with it being so close to you, have you experienced any other activity out there that's paranormal of sorts? Or is your stuff pretty classic Bigfoot natural?
So I'm pretty classic Bigfoot natural, but I did have a particular, it was a pretty jarring experience one night. I was fishing on the river, the Merrimack River, and I did that thing I always do where I stay a little too late. I tell myself just one more cast, and next thing you know, the sun was starting to set, and I had to take the 2.5 mile hike back to the truck. I turn on the headlamp, and I start walking, and I'm already a little, I don't know what unnerved me, but this particular evening, It was an unfamiliar area to me. I just hadn't fished there before, and the trail wasn't super clearly marked. It was kind of just follow the river until you get to your car. So I'm kind of stomping through these reeds. I'm stomping through this tree line, and I feel like I hear footsteps somewhere, maybe deep in the woods. And it's just this rhythmic stepping that really had me spooked. And I stopped for a second because I'm like, hey, well, maybe I can identify what this is. And this was, mind you, this is probably 2 or 3 years ago. So this is before I was really, really thinking, you know, maybe that's Bigfoot. But I stopped and the footsteps stopped. And I just hear like a, and I hear like this goat. And I think nothing of it. But then I hear fast footsteps and I start running at that point. So I couldn't identify if that literally was just some goat that had wandered down by the river or if that was, you know, some kind of malevolent creature. I just didn't know, but I didn't stop to ask questions. I just ran.
It sounds like you got chased by Baphomet.
That's an awfully scary thought, but
yeah. Some strange things up in those woods. I've really heard some stories about in New Hampshire specifically about the giant owls that are there, Sasquatch, what else? Oh, dogman activity, all in this one particular town and area. But I've heard, and so hearing that you got chased by a potential malevolent goat spirit, just that's like, you know, par for the course, I feel like, with that area.
Absolutely. And there is actually, I was talking to another gentleman who introduced me to the concept of the woods devil, which is another type of creature that's up in north New Hampshire. But when I was thinking about north New Hampshire and that, it kind of sounded like maybe potentially that was the bear-like creature I saw. There was just so many different things to look into. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it was this, maybe it was that. But, you know, maybe I'll just never know.
With your research, you say you're going out two or three times a week if you can. What are some of the goals that you have with this research? Is it to bring more of a scientific awareness to it? Is it kind of like you had this experience, you launched headfirst into it, and now you're obsessed with it, kind of like how some of us get? Or what's kind of your goal with this research?
So if I was a less selfish man, I would want to say that it's, you know, scientific in nature to try to gather data, but really, I just love being out in the woods. I want to experience as much as this area's got to offer. So I often find myself out there just to enjoy it while I can. And the finding Bigfoot is kind of the secondary goal. Now, I definitely want to see if I can experience that again someday. That, you know, that very unreal, just kind of a visceral feeling in your gut. And that's kind of what I'm out there for, is to find it again. And in the most recent couple of months, we've started documenting this in a serious note, and that's how kind of Squatch Hunters International got its footing. So now we're all out there. We're actually trying to, you know, bring attention to some of the stuff we find. It's not just maybe that could be something. It's, no, I want to document this. I want to share this with the community, and I want to see what other people online have to say about it.
Can you share a little bit more about the group? I know you've mentioned it, but how did you guys get started? And if you have any stories about the Florida correspondence, I'd love to hear it.
Well, it was really, we've known each other for a very long time. We're old college friends, and we often find ourselves on Discord of all places pretty much every weekend. You know, we'll be talking about something, we'll be playing some games, we'll be doing something to catch up with each other. And just in the last few months, this was, again, after my kind of experience with Ronnie LeBlanc, I decided that, hey, guys, remember how we would kind of talk about this occasionally? You know, Colorado's got pretty big Bigfoot culture, so they're all intimately familiar with what I was talking about. That's kind of what kickstarted this as a concept. Like, let's go ahead and take some of our experiences, take some of our documentation, and put this out there for everyone to see. So just to talk a little bit about some of them. So we have our correspondent up in Washington. His handle is his True Believer, and he's a bit of a goofball. He believes in like he's super paranormal. He's every type of conspiracy theory you could think of, he believes in it one way or another. He's got some very interesting thoughts about artificial intelligence. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Right, I'll be writing him about finding out what his thoughts are on AI.
He's a pretty much a doomsayer in that regard, but he wrote an article on that recently. So that's something about the AI hallucinations. I don't know if you've heard about those, but it's very concerning.
It is. It really is.
So maybe we can talk about. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, did you see the new news story of the guy who's like, yeah, so I cried my eyes out the moment that I proposed, because he proposed to his AI. And at first you're just like, oh, okay, this is just kind of a weird guy, but okay. And then in pans the fiance. He has a fiance and child who he lives with. And the interviewer's like, are you jealous of the AI at all? And she's like, well, I was, because I was wondering. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is this is crazy. Like, I thought, oh, okay, he's just in love with AI. But he has a whole wife and child, a toddler that they're raising. So yeah, AI is out of control. It's crazy.
I did see that. I think the interviewer actually asked him, if you had to choose between your flesh and blood fiance or the AI, would you be able to make that decision? And he's like, I don't know, that'd be tough.
He's like, don't put me on the spot.
Yeah, don't put me in that position, man.
Yeah.
But our Florida correspondent, so he actually has, he's a bit of a madman. He's always out on the water. he's on the coast, and I'll hear about some hurricane that's coming through, and he tells me, oh, I'm going out wind sailing on this stuff. So he's out there on a kite. He's trying to get some speed on there. And many years ago, he was actually out there on the water, and he was attacked by something. And he couldn't tell what it was in that moment, but he lost a couple of digits on his right hand from that. And he just, to this day, does not know what did it out there. Like, was it a shark? Was it something outside of that kind of natural realm? And that's kind of what got him interested in seeking the paranormal. He's out there looking for his fingers.
Right. Was he in the Gulf when that happened?
No, he was on the
Atlantic side.
Yeah, Atlantic side. Okay. I wasn't sure if that was the term or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's mostly on the water, but he does have a couple of experiences out there that he likes to share with us. And maybe next time we could talk a little more about that.
Yeah, that would be great. Obviously, I live in Florida, and
right.
I've heard of some interesting things, especially off the Gulf. I'm on the Gulf side specifically. Mm-hmm. Strange water creatures. That is interesting. I just had a conversation with another podcaster about Leviathan. So, and just about all of the vastness of the ocean and how just uncharted it is and unknown and all the possibilities that could be there. So that's pretty jarring.
That's the second thing I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of heights. I'm also afraid of the ocean. Like, I cannot be out there with open water because I just don't like the idea of what's floating down there. It could be anything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What other states are you guys in? You have Washington, Florida, the New England area.
And then our other, we have one correspondent down in Texas. She's pretty light. We'll see things from her occasionally. But just every once in a while, we'll get a blip from her. And then we have Boone out of Colorado, and he's probably one of our more active correspondents. He's out there all the time. He's either skiing or in the winter, or he's out there hiking or rafting in the summer. And I'm actually probably going to be doing an interview with him. And we're going to be starting a podcast soon. And one of our first episodes is going to be an interview into his rafting techniques. So that's another one of those situations where it's like, hey, I'm rafting on the water. We're going to cover a lot of territory right now. Why don't we go ahead and see what we can find out there, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a really cool thing is how you can get further in a raft or a kayak and really get into those remote places.
Well, yeah, especially you're talking about a river with, you know, class, whatever level rapids, you're scooting along. You'll get the many miles in a day.
Yeah, no kidding. I know we really like to, rely on e-bikes a lot down here, and we try to get as far back as possible. And there are some different locations that we've talked about kayaking into because it's like you see it right over the water and you're like, man, I just want to get over there. If I can get over there and just research, I know there's going to be a print.
Yeah, we always thought about doing some kind of e-bike situation, but everything here is either straight up a cliff. Like there's so much elevation gain, you just can't quite get that vehicle to scoot along the way it did there.
No, you might as well have a dirt bike at that point, and then you wouldn't be probably allowed on most of the trails. Yeah, the e-bike is great for Florida because where I research, it's primarily flat. You said you're starting a podcast. When should we be on the lookout for that? And is it going to be Bigfoot related? Or I know you said the first episode was going to be on rafting. So is it going to be maybe more focused on the outdoors and that active lifestyle? Or is it going to have a little bit of a Bigfoot twist?
So it's certainly going to be a little more Bigfoot focused. And I kind of want to also dive into some of the other local cryptids based on where our correspondents are. That is one thing that I think doesn't get enough coverage is the local cryptids, the small guys that, you know, don't get the spotlight like your, you know, Chupacabra or your Bigfoot does, but like the little Pudgy or the Chanthalink, you know, those little local creatures. I want to feature those and also talk about our various, you know, squatching adventures and see what we can get out there in the airwaves.
Is there any particular local cryptid that's kind of your personal favorite?
So I gotta say, I do have a soft spot for Champ. That was one of the first things when I moved here. I went to an entire museum for Champ the Lake Monster up in Burlington, Vermont. And some of the trivia about that guy, like Vermont actually has laws passed that says you're not allowed to harass Champ. So if you are out there and you see Champ on the water and you do anything to harm that beautiful creature, you better believe you're going to be doing some hard time in jail. That's how much the locals care about that guy.
I love that. That always interests me when local governments make laws based off of cryptids, because why are you making a throwaway law if it doesn't exist?
Exactly.
Because it's written into the hunting regulations here in Florida that you cannot shoot a skunk ape. Like, specifically, it says that.
Kidding.
Why would you include that if it's not real? It's just, that always gets me when government agencies do that. And one of my questions for you is, what do you think about that? Do you think the government knows about these creatures and that they're intentionally suppressing it?
Oh, the government knows far more than they let on in all sorts of regards. When we had the different UFO leaks that came out, they've got to have archives of data that they just aren't releasing to the public. And I would not be surprised in the slightest if there happened to be, you know, a couple of files in there on Bigfoot and its progeny, because, you know, different parts of the country have very similar sightings of a very similar creature, and worldwide, that's, you know, you got similar creatures being described in South America. You've got the Bukawari in Africa. You've got different variations there. Like, it's got a lot of consistency, and I wouldn't be surprised if government knows a little bit more than they're letting on.
Absolutely. And like in your name, you said it's international.
That's right.
It is all over. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to share or talk about tonight that maybe we didn't cover?
No, you've been too kind with your time. We've talked about a lot, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to you about it. I just love talking to anyone who will listen about, you know, about my findings out there and about, you know, what it's like to get out there and get squatching. So I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you.
Absolutely. Well, let the listeners know where they can find you and all your great work.
Yeah, so primarily we're on Instagram. That's Squatch Hunters International. The handle is www.squatchhunter, worldwide Squatch Hunter, for those who remember the old World Wide Web days. And you can also find us on SquatchHuntersInternational.com. That's where you'll find some of the articles written by me and by True Believer. And the podcast should be coming up, I want to say, in the next month. I still got to take a little time to familiarize myself with the software. But the Squatch Hunters International podcast should be up in a few weeks, and you can find that wherever you find all podcasts.
And that's going to wrap up another deep dive into the shadows here on Dark Florida. A huge thanks to Jeb Scruggs for joining me tonight and sharing his incredible experiences and insight into the mysteries of the White Mountains. Whether you believe Bigfoot is just a myth or something flesh and blood still roaming the forest, I think tonight gave us all a lot to think about. If you loved this episode, make sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you've got a story of your own, strange or unexplainable, I want to hear it. You can reach me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow our Instagram at darkfloridapodcast. And you can support the show at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. Thanks for listening to Dark Florida. Keep your flashlight close and your eyes on the trees. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.